Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. Episode 242, it's about merchant traders, Natal plantations, African farmers, and the Harry Smith Sourveld land swindler. It's also about putting plows in the ground, how the rural areas of much of the country were experiencing something of an agricultural revolution. It's rather a fascinating tale because there are tremendous contradictions in what we're going to hear about this episode. As usual, we'll need to combine a global story with the local story. Without doing so, is to stunt awareness of the strands and tendrils that spread and connect. By the 1850s, Great Britain was manipulating trade and the military, as well as political power, as reciprocating elements. This is a technique adopted by pretty much every empire since before Carthage. Political influence was used so as to extend and secure free exchange. In Britain's case, commerce and anglicization spread political influence and weld alliances. As Lord Palmerston so aptly pointed out, it is the business of government to open and secure the roads for the merchant. Antiquated regimes were its enemy and foreign tariffs were its enemy too. As anyone knows, the greatest enemy of free trade is tariffs. Empires were broken, the gouty and outdated Chinese, the religion-strangled Turkey. Innumerable sheikdoms, sultanates, and chieftaincies were drawn into the invisible British Empire of informal sway. When the merchants manage affairs instead of men with guns, it's harder to pin down the essence of power and also the dangers. The results of this grand vision were not encouraging by the 1870s, and the Victorians were less sure of their panacea for both Asia and Africa. Among the ancient and invincibly conservative Confucian and Islamic rulers, no effective westernizing collaborators had been found. The Taiping Rebellion in China and the growing chaos in Muslim states appeared never-ending. It was the United States that was gobbling up immigrants. Most of Britain's emigrants went there, and the Victorians bought and sold more there than in any other single country. It had dawned on the British political elite that their commercial experience impressed a single portentous fact, that the most successful trading associations, with the exception of the Indian Empire, were with Europeans transplanted abroad. They accounted for around 70% of all her investment overseas. The white communities in the temperate zones had the outlook and the institutions favorable to progress, which the Asiatics and Africans seemed to lack. They offered customers with European tastes and money to spend. Mutual self-interest with whites of their empire meant private business of Great Britain commingled freely with that of Greater Britain and the once colonial societies of the New World, the Americans, and many in South America too. It was this reason that independent American Republicans and self-governing British colonials seemed to be the best collaborators in the Victorian world mission. Protective tariffs were deemed commercial suicide. Empire, by definition, meant extended family of mother country and colonial sons. By comparison, the Indian Empire seemed unnatural, like some extramarital responsibility incurred in a lustful youth, and there was a strong prejudice against allowing it to happen again. Hence, ministers were unwilling to annex more provinces around the world and only did so when their colonials required such territories. While the settlers were expropriating the lands of the Aborigine, the Maori, and the Africans, there was no alternative government at first to Mr. Mother Country. As Ronald Robinson says in his book Africa and the Victorians, a tiredness had crept into the Victorians by the 1870s, tired of guarding the extended frontiers, of trying to enforce some kind of justice between settler and African. And at the same time, the colonists were growing more bitter about Downing Street control, and self-government appeared a solution. The aim was to avert the loss of more colonies and more American wars of independence. So by the 1870s, Confederated Canada, responsibly governed Australia, and the Cape were regarded as constitutional embodiments of collaboration between British and colonial interests, all working at their best. According to the official canons, the tomes and reports generated by empire lackeys, there seemed no reason for empire anywhere in tropical Africa. British enterprise did not look like providing enough cash for colonists there, and African societies had yet to provide the trade and revenue or local allies. It was very different in temperate southern Africa. There were colonists here, but very few were British. The Boers had spread out across the Orange and Vaal rivers, and that unnerved the Victorians despite their support of European colonisation. During the century, the British government had supported black chiefs more than the Boers, restricting settlements, reducing direct trade, partly to avoid costly frontier wars, but mostly because they wanted to command Simon's Bay and the coastline to India. This hesitancy was going to fade away in the coming decades as the scramble for Africa set off a colonization frenzy amongst European nations, including Great Britain. All of this needs to be digested because there was a sleeping giant awakening, African farmers. The principal resource was land, but the relationship between people and the land was not purely economic. The members of the clan depended on land not merely for subsistence, but also for recognition of being members of a social group. The allocation of land to an individual was a badge of membership to that clan or tribe. Land was the communal property of the political community, although property rights were barely defined, as long as land was a plentiful resource. By the 1870s, the plentiful resource had turned into short supply across most of southern Africa. Land belonged to the group or tribe. It was not owned, but was treated as an individual's right only because he or she worked it. Property rights were formally vested in the chief, who acted as the allocator of land to his followers. Conversely, it was because of his generosity in handing out land that he gained followers. That was going to change radically, as you'll hear. The new African farmers were levelling up. They began to chafe and break the old traditional bonds where the chiefs provided power through cattle, because men and women were now earning cash by working in towns and on the new diamond fields of Kimberley. Once an individual had been allocated land in the old days, he was only in charge of that property if he worked it. He and his family had to actually farm the land or use it to herd his animals. So in a nutshell, it was communal ownership and individual cultivation. Confusing, of course, because that's not how the settlers viewed the land at all. For one thing, the only fence that the African farmers erected was the cattle enclosure, the kraal, to protect their important animals at night from the lions and the leopards and hyenas and other humans who were prowling about looking for an easy meal. The only form of real wealth before the development of commercial farming by African agrarians was cattle. The machinery of improving wealth was vested once again in the hands of the chief. He permitted distribution of this cattle wealth by assigning minor chiefs the rights to look after his significant herd. Private ownership of cattle and the other livestock was loosely regulated in most African societies, and at the death of a well-off man, his cattle would be redistributed to all his distant matrilineal relatives. Older men often accumulated a large number of cattle. Those who became too wealthy, competed with the chief, found their herds eaten up, as it was known, confiscated, because he was flashing too much bovine bling. Many of the first farmers had deployed a shifting or current technique where they would allow land to lay fallow, a shifting cultivation known as bush fallow. In the wooded areas of the Eastern Cape and the Transkei, shifting cultivation was the best that could have been devised and, in general, well adapted to produce subsistence means with the least amount of labour. It is a myth to describe these original farmers as having no clue about how the land worked. They actually developed and deployed advanced knowledge and techniques at every stage of the agricultural cycle. This began with deciding which land to use for cattle kraals and granaries and which to clear for cultivation. They knew which soil types provided the highest return, and a soil's fertility was judged closely according to what wild grasses and other flora grew in it. Sowing time was judged based on climatic conditions and indications in the wild. Elders were in charge of this process, an ancient skill handed down generation to generation. So it was to be then that labouring in the towns freed up the poorer African farmer. But over time, the knowledge gleaned from millennia was going to almost disappear in urbanising black South Africa. Anthropologists discovered that the Nguni and other people of the South had a comprehensive knowledge of the environment. It was wide-ranging, subtle and fruitful. Every adult person knew the name of all the trees, the shrubs, the grasses, and all the plants, the insects, the birds, the reptiles, and the major wildlife. They also knew about the birds, the insect and animal habits and customs, how they reproduced and how they could use the fauna and flora. When these farmers began to use Western implements, such as the American plow, productivity shot up. little farms began to produce surplus grain, and in parts of South Africa, black farmers emerged as competition to the settlers. The district of Pedi in 1870 produced more corn than colonial farms. In Keiskamahoek, they improved wool quality and sold this through merchants in King Williamstown. It was Amaxhosa farmers providing these products. The Amamfengu, those former refugees living in what was called Fingoland across the Kai and the Transkei, sold or bartered at least 500 wagon loads of corn into Tlaleka and Amatembu districts in 1872. The wool trade by these people was valued at £60,000. By 1873, the Amamfengu population had reached 44,000, and one in eight families used this new American plough. They had 440 wagons rolling about their farms. They raised money to build schools. Blytheswood cost £4,500. This was a sister school of Lovedale. The Amamfengu coughed up £7,000 for roads and paid church and school fees and rates and taxes and other fees to the Cape government. There was a feeling that development was a good thing, so the Amamfengu held a meeting in 1873 and agreed to pay a special levy so that a new bridge could be built over the mighty Kai River. The number of trading stores in the Transkei quadrupled to a few hundred, and all of this meant that there was a major qualitative shift in the consumption patterns of Africans. New permanent wants replaced needs. Metal was now preferred to traditionally crafted pots and baskets, and cowhide carosses were replaced by the Whitney blanket, as ploughs and all manner of tools flooded into these developing farms. The Whitney blanket was a classic British wool blanket made in the town of Whitney in Oxfordshire. Powered by the River Windrush, Whitney's mills washed, felted and finished Cotswold and Welsh wools. Workers raised the nap with teasels, then sheared and pressed the cloth to a dense, soft finish that was warm yet hard wearing. By the 1800s, Whitney was a byword for quality. Whitney supplied the British Army and the Navy and hospitals and households and exported worldwide. They also manufactured the famous Hudson Bay Point blankets, with its stitched lines denoting size and weight, sending them across the Atlantic for the fur trade. Horse blankets and travel rugs were a major sideline. Victorians prized them because they were durable, warm and washable. The South African rural dwellers knew quality when they felt it, and Whitney blankets draped many a Basutu pony or the Amantembu shoulder. The commercial options and perceptions grew. New wares that were sampled as novelties or exotics became part of material requirements. African involvement in the money economy also led to a change from discretionary to necessary spending. Implements, clothes, metal goods, new fuel types and foodstuffs became items of subsistence. Transport riding, wool production, new crops like corn replacing sorghum, all of these innovations led to more cash in more black hands. During the 1870s then, two opposing and dialectically related sets of interests were plainly visible. The increased demands by settler farms for labour and an increased attempt by Africans to find alternative forms of income than that low-paid wage labour. This began to challenge the traditional power of the chiefs, who up until then had maintained their hold over production by drip-feeding their people cattle rights along with marriage rituals and handing out land in a form of biased lottery. The traditional order began to tear. Around South Africa, energies surged. Take the Highveld, for example, the Sauerveld of the Harry Smith district, to be precise. Largely used for summer grazing, the farmers here often moved their herds into Natal every autumn, below the Berg, as they put it, Onneberg, Underberg. Harry Smith remained a tiny dorp until the 1860s, when white farmers settled for longer periods in the vicinity of the town to serve the trade route down to the coast. It is life's rich ironies that this route is still dominated by stops like Montrose, with its fisherways and Mug and Bean on the road down Van Rienen's Pass, only a short distance from Harrismith. Back in the day, fodder and food was the trade, and the Boers living around Harrismith were happy to oblige. But the Sauerveld was not empty, it just looked that way. The Batlokwa community lived around the town, and the Boers began to view the Batlokwa as a threat to their security and their stock. In 1864, Chief Letika Tsotsetsi and his Batlokwa followers moved from the Sand River within the Free State and settled at Mill River Valley north of Harrismith. Other smaller Batlokwa clans were already living there, but the land was actually held by speculators, white speculators, who had not occupied their claims. Chief Tsotsetsi's people also settled on land belonging to Commandant de Villiers, who'd been appointed superintendent to the Batlokwa settlement after the wars against Moshweshwe. The Batlokwa had fought alongside the Boers and felt they were owed the land as payment for the many hundreds of casualties they took. Henceforth, Letiko Tsotsetsi was called the chief of the Harry Smith Batlokwa. A Kolokoi chief called Khlomise also moved onto de Villiers' farm. De Villiers then approached the Free State Volksraad, urging them to pay him a proportion of the hut tax from the Batlokwa and the Kolokoi as rent. The Africans on his land paid most of the £250 in hut tax collected from the entire Harry Smith district. The Volksraad believed that de Villiers owned all three farms along the Mill River. He didn't, he only owned one. De Villiers was now beginning to show a talent for fraudulent land deals. His membership of the Volksraad and his position as commandant of the Harry Smith forces in the wars against Moshweshwe placed him in an admirable position for his activities. It's a long story, too long to complete here. Suffice to say that he had hatched a strategy to enrich himself at the expense of the Batlokwa and Kolokoi. The truth would only emerge in a vigorously pursued land claim by these clans after the Anglo-Boer War, in 30 years' time. These two groups paid de Villiers more than 7,000 head of cattle for the land that he didn't own. It emerged later that he had engaged in a fraud of biblical proportions, claiming ownership of 2,190 square miles of land which the Batlokwa and Kolokoi bought from him, but were actually owned by white settlers, many of them urban dwellers in Durban and Bloemfontein and Cape Town. It worked like this. De Villiers would recon a bit of prime Harry Smith located land, sell it to the two chiefs, then approach the white owners who had no idea what was going on and buying the land from them cheap. Sometimes they refused to sell, but that didn't stop de Villiers from flogging it to the African chiefs anyway. Who was going to find out, he thought. The discovery of diamonds in Griqualand West gave de Villiers a big break. Land prices soared, and by now de Villiers had a dream of becoming South Africa's first really big land baron. The Volksraad and Bloemfontein were blissfully unaware of these private dealings. Later it emerged that de Villiers' own son had settled on the farm Strathnan, bought by the Harry Smith Commandant in 1872 and then sold to the Africans. By 1876, a Volksraad Commission of Inquiry discovered that £975 worth of hut tax was in arrears in Harry Smith, and yes, you guessed it, a major culprit was de Villiers. But he was to die long before the Anglo-Boer War and never found out that he had been found out. This rebellious culture is trackable in the area. Harry Smith is a tough place to this day, intersecting the Free State, Natal, and the Highveld, as well as Lesotho nearby. It's a place we'll explore regularly. Now it's time to turn our trusty steeds south-east and trundle down the hill. In Natal, the legislature had raised duties on imported sugar, and planter interests were further extended through free import schedules. All seeds, plants, and manures for agricultural purposes were introduced free of duty, alongside machinery necessary for processing all products of the soil, as the law put it. By the 1870s, the number of relatively large estates had increased. 9 estates on both the north and south coasts of Natal cultivated 600 acres or more, and yet the average-sized estate remained well below 300 acres. Most of these were held on freehold tenure, purchased either from the government or in an ostensibly competitive market for white settler land, largely occupied by individual resident planters. Some, like the Mzinto Sugar Company, were leasing arrangements, while leasehold tenure was also to be found in the Isipingo area of the south coast. Natal planters had a proportionately high degree of capital invested in the industrial sectors of their estates through the mills. Most mills generated between 6 and 15 horsepower, although the Reunion estate mill of the Pa, Spence and Co. could generate up to 25 horsepower. By the 1870s, Natal mills were regarded as modern. Out of the 60 operating, 56 were steam-driven. Previously, they'd been primitive, wind, water, and animal-powered. The average number of Indian labourers was around 51 per estate. Skilled work, though, was generally performed by Europeans, although some came from Mauritius, ushering in a lengthy tradition of Mauritians and Italians exchanging skilled labourers. It still goes on today. There was a consolidation going on when it came to the estates, particularly in the decade up to 1874. The Mzinto Company ran into financial difficulties and was bought out by the Reynolds brothers. All of these changes meant that Natal banks of the time regarded the sugar farmers with a degree of hostility. The Natal Bank in 1870 was stung by the losses at Craigieburn and Cornubia Estates, while the Standard Bank lost money in Natal through this period. The lack of credit drove many planters into the hands of merchant brokers who charge extremely high interest, and the Natal industry began to resemble older plantation economies of the West Indies. Unlike the West Indies, which exported its sugar to Europe and North America, Natal customs stats indicate that the Cape Colony absorbed more than 50% of all Natal sugar exported by sea. The Boer Republics and Griqualand diamond fields were next biggest, and that was to remain that until the discovery of gold in Johannesburg. While other farming areas were buffeted by world market shifts, the weather and economic headwinds, Natal was in a league of its own, buffeted even more. The plantation system stifled growth, and the industry did not experience a period of sustained expansion until the opening of Zululand to English and Boer settlements after 1905. Export prices of Natal sugar peaked in 1878, then collapsed until the next century. Land, speculation, fraud, it's one of our national sports. Thus, we've roamed South Africa this episode and beyond, peeking into the smoking rooms of English power, snuck a quick glance at how African culture was changing with the advent of new material goods, and of course Commandant de Villiers would be land baron of the Free State, not to mention Natal's sugar plantations beginning to look a little like the 18th century West Indies. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform. It helps elevate its visibility. You can head off to desmondlatham.blog. I'm loading updates about these episodes. You can email me from there or sign up for a newsletter. Until next, tot ziens.